Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, Ian Tuttle of National Review, and for the vacationing Jim Garrity today, good, crazy, and still crazy martinis for you today. We'll skip the bad, although you can probably say that either one of the crazies could probably qualify in that category. Ian, it's great to have you with us.
Oh, glad to be here.
Let's start with the good, and anytime we've got potentially bad news for Hillary Clinton, it's usually pretty good news for conservatives. And we got two different polls coming out. One is from Suffolk University, and the other is from Quinnipiac, and they're looking like things are not as stellar for Hillary Clinton as she would like them to be. According to the Suffolk University poll, among voters in New Hampshire, Clinton is leading Bernie Sanders by only 10 points now, 41% to 31%. She's got a 19-point lead among female voters, but she's losing to Sanders among men, 35% to 32%. And it gets even worse for her because the poll says among those who said that they actually know both of the candidates, Clinton's edge over Sanders grows slimmer, 38% to 35%. And then as far as Quinnipiac, they take what they call a swing state poll of Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Florida. And apparently Hillary Clinton does not feel people's pain nearly as well as her husband did a couple of decades ago. Because when it comes to whether or not she cares about voters, Clinton got a 48 to 46 divide in Florida. Both Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio beat her on that question in the poll. It's split among Ohio voters, 48-48, as to whether Hillary cares about them, and she's underwater, 51-45 in Pennsylvania. So it's still highly likely that Hillary Clinton will be the runaway winner of the Democratic nomination, but she's still piling up a huge amount of baggage here.
Yeah, that's right. So I think it's worth making two points, one about Bernie and one about the Quinnipiac poll. So I think what you're going to see in New Hampshire, probably, perhaps a couple other Democratic primary states, is probably a protest vote. Knowing that Hillary is almost certainly going to lock down the nomination easily, you'll have the Bernie voters, the, quote, Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party, that essentially casts a vote against her, knowing that it's not going to affect the outcome, but hoping that it sends a message. So, you know, it's possible that Sanders could win a state here and there, but the likelihood is against it. But even if he shows well in some of these states, it's likely to pull Hillary left, which is what a lot of these voters want to do because they're deeply dissatisfied with her. They don't know where she stands on issues. They don't think she's authentic. In a state like New Hampshire, you already have voters who are very independent-minded, sort of been New Hampshire's political characteristics since colonial days. So that's the first takeaway. On the Quinnipiac side, on the polls showing that swing state voters are not sure whether she cares, I think this is perhaps the more significant finding, because if it remains, and I don't see any reason why it would not, the problem is not for Hillary, I think, is less that voters are going to switch, although that's possible depending on who the Republican candidate turns out to be. The problem is that they just don't show. Take this as anecdotal evidence. I had a conversation with a self-identifying progressive a couple weeks ago, and she said if the general election ended up being Clinton-Bush, she might just not come out. That is a much bigger problem for Democrats than for Republicans because they need the turnout. Republicans will show up simply to oppose Hillary, even if they don't necessarily like the candidate, I think. I don't think Democrats will. I think the dissatisfaction with her is so strong that they just might not show. And in key states, Florida, especially if you have Bush or Rubio at the top of the ticket, Ohio, potentially Pennsylvania, that could be a real problem.
Certainly could. And it brings up a couple of interesting points because this is the question, you probably remember, Ian, that really killed Mitt Romney in the exit polls in 2012 when it came to specific issues. A lot of people thought more highly of Romney than Obama, but when it came to does this person care about me, Obama trounced him. I don't remember exactly what the numbers were,
yeah,
but it was
right.
Substantial. So even if the Republican isn't getting great numbers, which they probably won't, if Hillary is hovering right around 500, that could take away a big chunk of the advantage that Obama enjoyed with his coalition, and that, of course, Hillary is trying to reassemble, it would appear, by moving further and further left. So on to the crazy martini number one now, and of course, part of Hillary Clinton's electoral fortunes will be determined by who she faces as the Republican nominee. And yesterday, we got an amazing, entertaining announcement from someone who I think just about everyone, if they're really honest, realizes will not be the Republican nominee. Here is a montage of a few different clips from Donald Trump, both from his actual announcement at Trump Tower that never seemed to end, as well as his reaction to a couple of the other candidates in the field when asked by ABC's George Stephanopoulos.
I would build a great wall, and nobody builds walls better than me, believe me. And I'll build them very inexpensively. I will build a great, great wall on our southern border, and I will have Mexico pay for that wall. Yeah. Mark my words. Yeah. I have a total net worth, and now with the increase, it'll be well over $10 billion. I'm not doing that to brag, because you know what? I don't have to brag. I don't have to, believe it or not.
Just give me your instant reaction. Okay. Jeb Bush.
I'd call him a stiff. I mean, I think he's a stiff. I watch him. I think he's somebody that doesn't want to do what he's doing. I don't know. Is he being forced to do it?
Marco Rubio.
I think he's highly overrated. I think he's an overrated person. I look at him. They say he's a young Ronald Reagan. I said, I don't think he's a young Ronald Reagan. And besides that, I have far better hair than he does. Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am officially running for President of the United States, and we are going to make our country great again.
Had to get the music in there. That was perhaps the most awkward part. So, Ian, we didn't even include the part where he talked about how he's really, really rich, how he sold an apartment for $15 million to a Chinese guy, so he doesn't hate all Chinese people. Not everybody who comes from Mexico is a rapist, and he would be the best jobs president that God ever created. So, an abundance of riches. Where do you even start here?
He doesn't lack for confidence, that's for sure. This is really a Christopher Buckley book waiting to happen, about our reality television commander-in-chief. That's sort of my problem with it. Well, I have many problems with it, but to go through them, if you're going to take him even modestly seriously, the fact is that he has a whole number of positions that, despite the media coverage, are just extraordinarily unconservative. He's touted single-payer health care. He's not in the slightest pro-life. There are a number of things that you can point to that would make him a far more palatable independent candidate, or even Democrat, perhaps in a different day and age, than a Republican. But I sort of don't much like talking about those things, because it gives him more credit than he's actually due. The main problem that I have is that he brings the reality television culture even more than it already has been into politics. You come into a room with Donald Trump and he sucks the possibility of any serious conversation. If he's on the debate stage, you're not dealing with a fundamentally serious person. You're dealing with a notorious self-promoter, a man who you certainly know from those clips and from his entire history is all about himself and developing his media personality. It's really sort of an embodiment, frankly, some of the trashier realities of popular culture. I don't think that it serves the Republican Party, but Americans to take him seriously as a political actor, and the more air you give him, the more you sort of tempt changing the political culture into the Kardashian culture.
Speaking of which, that's a perfect transition
into exactly.
into our third martini, our second crazy martini. And if anyone fit the pop culture reality that we face right now, the Rachel Dolezal story certainly has done that over the past several days. I think today is actually the first day we've addressed it on the Three Martini Lunch. This is the woman who, until recently, led the Spokane, Washington chapter, the NAACP. Then her parents informed the world that she's not actually black. She's kind of pretending to be black, but she was actually our biological daughter, so she's very much white. She ended up resigning her position with the NAACP, but then had This exchange is part of an amazing interview with Matt Lauer on NBC's Today Show on Tuesday.
Are you an African-American woman?
I identify as black.
You identify as black. Let me put a picture up of you in your early 20s, though. Is this an African-American woman, or is that a Caucasian woman?
I would say that visibly she would be identified as white by people who see her.
But at the time, were you identifying yourself as African-American?
In that picture, during that time, no.
And so the story only gets weirder and weirder. She's now claiming, Ian, that there's no proof that she's the biological daughter of the parents that essentially outed her. Now there's reports in the Daily Mail that there's a sex tape that exists of her. She also claims to be bisexual. She's the cultural slide of America wrapped up into one here.
Yeah, there are a million different things you can say about this. And I don't want to rehash too much of the commentary that's already out there, but let me sort of contextualize. One of the questions that conservatives asked, naturally, obviously, when the story broke last week, is how is the left going to respond? Because there seems to be a logical problem here. If Bruce Jenner can identify as Caitlyn Jenner, a man as a woman, then why can't someone identify as a different race, which has always sort of been a hypothetical that's out there, but it had never been manifest until Rachel Dolezal gave her the gift of herself to America. That has been thoroughly hashed out over the past week. What's interesting about the interview last night and the revelations in the Daily Mail is you're getting some people who are saying she's a pathological liar, which seems to me to be obviously true. The problem, though, is that the left has effectively acceded to the idea that truth and belief are indistinguishable. So if you want to say she's a liar, you have to say there's a legitimate, accepted, objective truth that she is lying about. The left has made that very, very difficult to do. The other part of pathological lying is mental illness. Well, if you say that she's crazy, what does that mean? Because the whole question of transgenderism up until 3 weeks ago was this was a mental illness. Well, now it's not a mental illness. Now it's just a social construct that we accept. It was abnormal. Now it's just normal and we need to deal with it. So you can't say, it seems to me, by progressivism's own internal logic, oh, Rachel Dolezal is just obviously crazy. It's just a matter of the window for normal, crazy, healthy, mentally ill hasn't shifted yet. It's simply a matter of time. My colleague Charles Cook has written that as soon as she threatens to commit suicide, that window will shift. I think, unfortunately, that's the case, that we're at a point in American culture where we're normalizing pathologies. It's a very dangerous place to be, and it equally applies to the normalization of Donald Trump as a major Republican candidate. We sort of have this crazy person who we've said, well, maybe he's not crazy.
It's been interesting to watch the left respond to this, because at the beginning they were all about calling her out for misrepresenting herself, but as time goes on and they see how active she's been on their issues over time, well, then suddenly it's okay. Jonathan Capehart was appalled last week. By yesterday, there were folks on MSNBC like Michael Eric Dyson saying, well, essentially, she's an ally of ours, so she might as well be black. When you have black conservatives who actually are black, they're not considered black because they don't hold the right political views.
So. Exactly. The left, whether it wants to make race a biological construct or a social construct, can have it work out for them both ways. But the problem is the left wants both the biological issue and the cultural issue. They want it to be a sort of biologically absolute thing. Rachel Dolezal is lying. Obviously, she's not black. And they want it to be a social construct. Well, you can have one or the other and the logic can work out, but you can't have both. And they want both.
Ian, thanks as always for filling in for Jim. We'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Thanks, Greg.
Ian Tuttle of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us. And tune in again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.